Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent update to share with you. As you probably know, this podcast is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. And with our financial year ending on June 30th, we're facing a $52,000 gap in funding that must be closed by that date. With just days to go, generous friends of the ministry have now offered to match every dollar given towards this goal up to $10,000. So please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really thrilled to have another guest on the show today, which is Andy Crouch, calling in from the United States. How are you, Andy?
I am doing well. I'm so glad to be with you all.
We're really pleased to have you on the show. For those who haven't come across you and your work, would you mind kind of briefly introducing yourself?
Oh, sure. Well, my daily work is with entrepreneurs, actually. I'm partner for theology and culture at an American organization called Praxis. And we work actually globally with people who are starting new ventures, both nonprofit and for-profit. And in my intersection with them, we try to bring theology, what we can say about God, and culture, what we're making of the world, into conversation with what they're building, which is just a fascinating kind of daily work. And then in my free time, I do sometimes write books, which is just a way of thinking out loud, and was a journalist in American religion for many years. So I love thinking about big ideas, and matters of life and death is about as big a framework for ideas as I can imagine. So I think I'm in the right place.
Very much are. We wanted to frame today's conversation around, well, at least to start with, something that I think has been very prominent on culture on both sides of the Atlantic over the last few months in particular, which is around young people, screens, smartphone use, social media. You know, are we raising a generation of damaged, insecure, mentally unwell teenagers because of the growth of smartphones, particularly led around the book The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, which has really been kind of taken the world by storm. Can I kick off by asking, you know, do you fundamentally buy into Haidt's thesis that the kind of growth, the spectacular growth in mental ill health among young people is not just correlated, but is caused by the explosion in usage of smartphones and social media apps?
Well, I think I do. This is something where I've also been very engaged. I mean, first of all, as a parent, we were raising children slightly earlier. Our children are now in their 20s. And so we missed maybe the latest iterations of digital media, but there definitely were lots of questions about screens. And out of that, I wrote a book that came out in 2017, which is an eon ago in technological terms, called The TechWise Family. And in that book, I tried to lay out at that time what I thought were some both perennial issues and pressing issues related to the proper place of technology in formative environments like the home. And I will tell you that as the book came out, this is in the late 2010s, I'd be speaking about it quite a bit. And then the first question, and I don't know if this is true in the UK, but in the United States, this is such a quintessential question that people ask about any kind of parenting or really kind of any moral or ethical matter these days. Someone will raise their hand and say, can you tell us what the data say about this? And it's a very interesting instinct that there must be experts who have data and just tell us the data, and then we'll act based on the data. And of course, there's a lot to be said for this because not all beliefs are true, and some are falsifiable by data. And what I would say in the late 2010s was, it's too early to have data, and social science is, with all respect to social scientists, including Jonathan Haidt, the weakest form of science, because the realities it deals with are so inherently complex. The lack of ability to do what we call, what we think of as a gold standard kind of randomized control trial experiments. You rarely can do that in social science. You never can do these kind of double-blinded trials that are how we get the highest standard of evidence, where neither experimenter nor patient, you might say, knows what's going on. You literally cannot do that with something like screens and family life. And so I would say, you know, honestly, the most important data you have is by the data you have about your own child. How is your child doing as you've introduced, whether it's a TV or video games or a smartphone into their life? Like, you have more better information than any aggregate social science survey is going to give you. Now, we're now 8 years later, and I think that John and his colleagues, most notably Jing Twenge, who's a collaborator of his, I think the evidence has tipped into a very high degree of confidence that something about introducing smartphones, and probably more specifically social media, broadly understood, there are these really dramatic, like hockey stick like changes in various ways we try to assess adolescent mental health. And, you know, the evidence is not, it will never be watertight. I mean, there was a review essay in Nature criticizing John's work, and Nature is a serious, prestigious scientific magazine. And that essay got past peer review. There are people who really don't think the evidence is all in. My own sense is we know enough now to be pretty sure these are not doing a lot of good, and to also be pretty sure that in adolescence, the harm is concentrated in girls, for reasons we might want to get into. Even though I will say, maybe to put a marker down for the next few minutes, I actually think the longer term harm is going to be greatest in boys and young men. But that's just a belief I have. It's not something I can prove with evidence right now. So, very long answer to your question, Tim. But yes, I think now, if someone raised their hand and asked me that question today, I'd say, oh, the preponderance of evidence. You know, is it enough to convict in a criminal trial where it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt? I don't know. Is it enough to get a judgment in a civil trial where, at least in the US, it's the preponderance of evidence? Absolutely.
Yeah, it is interesting from a scientific perspective, because, of course, what is often said, and quite rightly, is that association, statistical association, is not the same as causation.
Yes.
But what is very important from a scientific point of view is that, therefore, you don't just look for statistical association, you look for something which has is what is often called biological plausibility, something that is there a plausible mechanism by which this intervention could have this effect. And for me, that is overwhelmingly yes. I mean,
yes.
It's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yes.
If you suddenly have this kind of digital heroin and spend however many hours it is per week staring at this little screen, that might have something to do with your general well-being and sense and anxiety levels and all that. Yes, it could possibly be something to do with it. And that, it seems, it's a bit sad that these, personally, I think, yes, all the scientists say, oh, no evidence, no. That it's a bit sad when you have such overwhelming biological plausibility.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, two thoughts on that. One is that it's not just what the phones may be doing. It's what they're substituting for. And one of the things they tend to substitute for, there are interesting exceptions, but is a physical activity, getting out in the world, moving through the world for younger children, but also for teenagers, even what we would call play. Play has been replaced. The play that probably all three of us experienced as children is now being substituted for by the play of video games or the kind of interaction with a screen. And we have incredible amounts of evidence, both kind of a scientific nature, but also just observational of what it is to be human, that play is incredibly important for children and that physical activity for children and adults. I have a psychiatrist friend who says if physical activity were a drug, we would be prescribing it for depression, like rampantly, and someone would be making huge profits if it could be, you know, if it were a drug, because the evidence is so robust that it's actually maybe, along with actually the most protective against depression, apparently turns out to be dancing. There's quite powerful evidence that dancing, which is like rhythmic movement with the other people in the world is incredibly protective against depression, but more generally physical activity. Like, we're absolutely sure of this. And none of these devices, the exception I'm thinking of is Pokemon Go, which was popular for a couple of years, that got you out in the world with your friends. And I actually think that was a great thing.
Getting run over as you went into the street.
Right. Well, yes. some risks, I suppose.
But it's interesting, isn't it? So one of the things that Jonathan Haidt talks about is risk, that actually taking physical risk, you know, doing things you probably wasn't a very sensible thing to do. But you know what?
Right.
I tried it and it was fun.
Totally.
That actually this is an important developmental process, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then he points out that taking risk in something like Call of Duty, you know, a video game,
right,
where you get killed regularly and you do ridiculous things and jump off to high buildings, so it doesn't work. It's not real risk.
That's right. And the people think of Jonathan Haidt's argument as being about the introduction of smartphones, but it's equally about the restriction of play. And again, I know the U.S. context much better than the U.K., but certainly in the U.S., there's been this dramatic out of a very vague and nebulous fear of something bad that would happen if children were unsupervised. There has been, actually, John coined this phrase, maximum security recess being the play hour at school, where he found, someone sent him this school, I'm sure it's in California, that has posted this long list of rules and regulations for who shall intervene when there's a conflict on the playground. And it stands in for all the ways that in the United States, out of this very vague fear that something bad will happen to our children, which has there is no evidence of that, like social science evidence, criminal evidence, there's just no
crime's
evidence.
Crime's been falling for decades.
Exactly. That we've restricted and supervised and regularized the experience of childhood. And even without the introduction of smartphones, that would have been damaging. But combined, and they've been very synergistic in a way, that is what's doing, I think, very plausibly, tremendous damage. And I don't think that rests on a very narrow base of some associational studies relating to screens or particular apps. It's a much broader, like, redefinition of childhood. That is, I mean, talk about a plausible mechanism. Very unlikely this would be better than the way human beings have developed and grown into mature human beings for all of history.
There's certainly a very similar trend. I've read things about, you know, they looked at different generations of families that lived in the same area, and they saw, you know, the grandfather, how far were they allowed to go unattended from the home?
Yes.
They could go up to 1.5 miles or something like that. And then the next generation, they were restricted to the end of the street. And then the current children are not allowed out of the front garden. And it has very clearly shrunk the kind of sphere in which parents feel able to give children kind of unrestricted access to. And I feel the same, you know. I mean, I remember, Dad, when we grew up in relatively central London, you would let me, as a primary school child, ride my bike up and down the street round the kind of slightly dodgy housing estate. And I now reflect as a father, when my daughter reaches 7 years old, would I just pack her off out of sight for hours at a time? Not 100% sure. So I think these trends affect all of us. Which is I don't know what the cause of that is. And when you were doing the research and thinking around for your book from a particularly Christian perspective, did you come up with a better kind of organizing principle then that we should be thinking about risk as parents and our children? And in terms of what is this, is there a specifically kind of Christian way to think about how we, you know, hold on to our responsibilities and look to protect our children and yet also give them the opportunity to do this kind of play that we're talking about that seems to be so beneficial?
Wow, that's such an interesting question. And yes, I do feel like I kind of stumbled on something. And I will say it was kind of after the fact in our parenting, or kind of working backwards to think about what had we done and why. It's very interesting. The central text of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible is the Shema Yisrael, which is in Deuteronomy. And when Jesus is asked, what is the greatest commandment? It's actually the one time that Jesus gives the expected answer to a question. I do not think at any other time that Jesus ever said what people expected when they asked him a question. In this case, he says what rabbis then and now would say, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And you know, that is embedded, interestingly, in Deuteronomy. The succeeding verses say, bind these commandments on your head and on your hands. And as you talk with your children, it actually specifically talks about parenting. It says, talk about this when you lie down, when you rise up, when you go out, when you come back. And it frames it as a kind of generational transmission of this vision of what it is to be, first of all, the people of the Lord, but also, I think, in some ways, to be fully human, because Israel is a restoration project in history to restore the fully human into a world broken by idolatry and injustice. And so what is there in the Shema is this vision of what we would call in kind of the Western philosophical tradition, human flourishing. And it is to be a heart, soul, mind, strength complex, I might say, designed for love. To be a human person is to have these different components of heart, soul, mind, and strength, and have them all developed, because it says, love with all your heart, love with all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. That implies not just kind of a passive or minimal amount of those things, but there's an allness invited and in a sense commanded, and order it all toward love. And this turns out to be a fantastic way to evaluate technology. Does it develop allness of heart, that is emotional range, you might say, the capacity to deeply weep, to just hilariously laugh? Does it develop depth of soul, connection to the depth of myself, the depth of others, and the depth of reality that we call God? Does it develop my mind? And then maybe most notably, does it develop strength, the physical body I've been given? And then you can ask, does it help me love? And when you start looking at technology that way, you realize it's not designed to do any of those things. It doesn't really develop any of those qualities. It's certainly not ordered toward love, as it's not deployed. And we don't buy these devices because we think this will enable me to like much more deeply live a life of love with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. It's just you wouldn't buy them for that purpose. Mm-hmm. We buy them for other reasons. And then I think the Shema and its surrounding text is so insightful, and this is a quintessentially Jewish idea, that the home is the place where this begins. This formation of someone who can love with heart, soul, mind, and strength begins in the relationship between parent and child and is transmitted as you are walking, as you're moving through the world. And I would extend that a little bit and say that my concern about technology, I think there's lots of places for the things that we call technology that are genuinely of value to human life. I just do not want them dominating what I would call formative environments. And I think there are three primary formative environments for human beings. The home is first, then school, which is where we are formed as members of a culture, you could say, and inducted into a cultural heritage and tradition. And then for those who are religious, and then specifically for those of us who are Christian, church. And church, home, and school are the places where you become a person and where you are meant to have fullness of heart, fullness of mind, fullness of soul, fullness of strength developed and ordered toward love. And in those environments, I think technology is very, very risky because it is rarely formative. So every moment you're spending, in a sense, I mean, even being entertained by the television or the TikTok video or whatever is a moment you're not spending actually telling a story together or making music together or having a conversation together. And when you're on the bus, I don't know that I'm that worried about it. But when you're in your home with these other people who are your primary formative community, especially parents and children, I'm very worried about it.
Hmm. That's really interesting. And it is interesting, isn't it? These communities, as you say, home, school, church, they're all small level communities.
Yes.
People call them intermediate communities, don't they? They come between the autonomous right. individual and then the world out there, the state.
Right.
And it's what we're created for. We're created for these intermediate, small scale communities. And isn't it interesting? Because it feels as though technology, in a way, effectively is obliterating those, isn't it?
Wow.
It's sort of...
Yes. Bringing them... Yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Keep going.
Well, bringing the mass environment, mass culture, sometimes literally the nation state, but frankly, our largest corporations today have larger like economic footprints than most nation states. Bringing that directly into the individual's life without the intermediating community that is actually the school of love. Yes, I think that's very important to recognize that's happening.
God. Well, just I mean, it goes off in many different ways.
We've all got thoughts.
We've all got thoughts. Fascinating. I mean, just as an aside, this is so important for democracy.
Indeed.
You know, that and that you know, the critique, that book by Patrick Deneen, do you remember that?
Sure.
That his critique was a lot to do with the loss of these intermediate communities.
That's
and
right.
Therefore, you're left with a kind of zero-sum game. You've either got the individualism, autonomy, or you've got the state power. And crudely, that's between libertarianism on the one hand and sort of state, leftist state on the other. And he says you've got to rediscover, just in terms of political life, civil life, these intermediate communities. Mm-hmm. That's one element of it, isn't it?
And you know, when you look at the way this is playing itself out in the vast nation called China, I think you see the state very much using technology to kind of disintermediate other communities, whether religious or really anything other than the state. I think in our Western world, you know, the situation is almost worse because states, that is political entities, do seek to justify themselves by their benefits for their citizens. And they at least have to be able to tell a plausible story about why it's good for you to be a citizen or a subject of China, for example. But now the dominant large-scale actors are corporations whose only responsibility, and sometimes quite explicitly only care or attention for all practical purposes, is maximizing profit for their shareholders. So Meta, the rechristened Facebook that owns Instagram and WhatsApp and many other verticals, they don't have to justify to anyone, we're making your lives better. I mean, Xi Jinping has to somehow be able to say on an annual basis to the people of China, trust me, submission to the state is going to make your life better. A politician in the UK or the US has to be able to say that. But Mark Zuckerberg does not have to say that. And when his own team comes to him and says, as they did, we have evidence this is harming young girls. We have evidence that Facebook and Instagram are destroying the mental health of a certain population of girls. He can ignore it because it is not part of his mandate. He's not accountable for it. And all of this is being rolled up into these big tech companies that really are there to maximize profit. So it's actually worse in a way than the political. It has profound political consequences in the West as well. But the real actors seeking to get the disintermediated attention of our children and us are not actually political for those of us who live in liberal democracies. They are corporations.
To bring this genuinely fascinating philosophical question, kind of tether it back down to ground, as I'm afraid this small-minded...
Oh, you're so boring.
I know.
So boring.
Forgive this journalist for trying to bring us back down to ground, but if I'm listening to this and I'm a parent, is the solution to kind of radically curtail usage of technology within those spaces, home, school, church? Are you effectively kind of espousing a kind of Christianized form of neo-Luddism where we say, you know, these things are good, but only in the right space? So like, fine, use your computer for work, but don't let your child watch TV at home.
Well, yes.
Yes, in a way. Word.
Yes. I mean, if I have to answer yes or no, yes. Because I'll say a couple things. One is, in our own family, we decided that before double digits, there would be no glowing rectangles in front of our children. So double digits, that is reaching the age of 10. I don't think this is like a, well, you know, it's a not a hard and fast number, but as a rough approximation for a decade of formation before you start interacting with this highly artificial presentation layer of modern technologies through screens, I just think there's no harm and great good in keeping keeping play and the work of childhood, which is play, in the real world, the non-glowing world. So we didn't have TV in our home before our kids were 10. We did not, mom and dad used screens for work and, you know, logistics and so forth, but the kids never were engaged in that way. And that sounds impossibly radical, I think, to many people. It's quite doable because, especially if you start when they're very small, within your home, they don't really know different. If you decide, like, we're just not going, that's not going to be what we do in our home. And then they might go to other people's homes and it was different. And we would just say, well, our family is different. But more generally, Tim, I will say, so I've obviously, you know, this is an area I've spent a lot of time on. I've talked with a lot of people about, and there's a whole spectrum of approaches to screens in the home from, extremely radical. I know one family, he's a university professor, very educated, accomplished family, who do not even, they don't even have Wi-Fi in their home. They heat their home with wood, which they chop themselves. Like they live in a suburb of Chicago, like not in a, they don't live in the woods. They live in a typical looking suburban home, except when you go in, you as a modern American or whatever would be disoriented because there's no TV. You can't get on the Wi-Fi. They've raised, I believe they have 9 children. It's a, wow. They're crazy. Okay. And their children who are now entering adulthood, they obviously a wide age range, are the happiest, kids their age I've ever met. The most, socially successful at university, doing incredibly well. The family and the marriage are in a sense enviable. Like I would love for my family and my marriage to feel the way this family does. And so you put that at one end, and then you put it at the other end, people are like, well, that ship has sailed. We all have screens. The kids need to have screens. And they just kind of go with the flow of the culture. And I will just tell you, whenever I meet people who are moving in the more radical direction, I see more health. And this family that I know in Chicago, they are far more radical than we are. But honestly, I would say they're healthier than we are. And I've never met. Now, I do think there is a form of fearful legalism that is very damaging. And there's a kind of fundamentalist, you know, fear of the world. And this family who I know is not like that. They're not, it's not their posture. I can imagine there are places and people who have that posture for whose children are emerge from that cocoon, very resentful. And, but if you are not fearful and legalistic, I frankly don't think you can be too radical on this. Yeah. When it comes to the home, again, I really use all this stuff at work every time, every day, and I have no objection to it. But for the formative environment, I don't think you're missing anything if you move in the Luddite direction.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is made possible by the generosity of friends like you. And right now, we're facing a $52,000 funding gap that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June 30th. Generous friends of the ministry have offered to match every dollar given up to $10,000. And so I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now. Your gift will help to keep important conversations like this one coming to listeners like you. Closing this gap in full by June 30th is vital. So please give your best gift today, knowing that your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I guess the challenge for a lot of us is, I think a lot of parents listening would be quite happy to be able to rein in their children's screen time. But what you're suggesting is that they have to do it for themselves as well. And so that means I have to get rid of my smartphone at home, and I can't scroll Instagram while they're, you know, having their breakfast, and I have to sacrifice. That's what I think is a lot of people's gonna be the sticking point.
Utterly so. And you know, when I speak about my book, which is called The Techwise Family, I say people think this is about screen time limits for kids, but it's actually not. I think it's not ultimately about screens. It's about formation. it's not really about limits. It's about what kind of flourishing we want. And it's definitely not about the kids. The reason we give kids screens primarily is not to solve their problems. It's to solve adults' problems. Children are given screens to solve parents' problems and teachers' problems. And there are some, speaking of, we were talking about the data earlier, there's this fascinating kind of econometric study that was done, published, well, in draft form. It hasn't been peer reviewed and published yet, but published as a draft paper in October 2023, that did a very large scale survey of college students and offered them the chance to sort of describe in dollars how much they would value TikTok and Instagram. Now, the really interesting thing is, if you ask them individually, how much is it worth it to you to be on TikTok and Instagram, they answer with a positive dollar amount. It's something like $60 a year. It's worth $60 for me to be on this. And they have a very sophisticated way of getting at this number. But when they say, you know, we're thinking about a study at your university where we would actually turn off access to Instagram for all your fellow students, and so it would no longer exist in your kind of social world. How much would you pay to, what would you pay or need to be paid for us to do that? And then the numbers flip. And it turns out that college students would pay $40 to $60 a year to have all their friends not have TikTok and Instagram. So they call this a product market trap, where for when everybody's using it, you need to be on it and you see that you gain some benefit from it. But your deep desire is for everybody to be off it. And this is not true. For example, if you do the same experiment with like maps, GPS navigation, it doesn't happen. People aren't like, take it away, take it away. But when you do it with social media, every college student is like, oh, I wish it didn't exist. I wish I didn't have to be on it. So we're not giving our kids something that has been like demonstrated to create flourishing in the world. We're, you know, if you get your 13-year-old on Instagram, you're giving them something that a 20-year-old on Instagram says, I wish this didn't exist. It's just that it's compulsory. Hmm. So just be aware of the trade-offs here.
And, you know, I think although it's an extreme example, it is like heroin, isn't it? It's digital heroin.
And that everybody's taking.
It is not by accident. It isn't heroin by accident. It's heroin by design.
By design. Wow.
And it's created to be addictive and mm-hmm. for commercial reasons. And yep. lo and behold, it's addictive. And then it's like asking people, would you rather not be on heroin?
Yeah.
And, you know, where they say, actually, you know what? If you could take the heroin away, it's great. But I can't because everyone else is on heroin. Of course, that's where it breaks down, because it's that kind of social thing. But
it is
something there, isn't there?
The collective action problem is a real one. And here in the US, and I'm sure it's present in some ways in the UK as well, the biggest problem parents have is they say, oh, I understand what you're saying completely. I wish we could get rid of it. But my kids are given tablets at school. And this is happening in first grade, very beginning of primary school. And the schools are the vector of, they're the dealers. I mean, and it's a very difficult, I feel very keenly for parents who have to push back against this. Because it's tough to push back. But I think it's our responsibility, not just as parents of our own children, but for the good of our neighbor, to push back.
And, you know, there's a further tweak to this, and that is that AI is being touted as the ultimate solution for education. Because what's going to happen is that this, instead of the teacher having to sort of deal with a whole class and try and find a way of managing a whole class, every right. student is going to have a personalized AI who is taking
tutor.
A tutor and taking them forward. But it's just occurred to me that effectively that's again collapsing the school as the intermediate
wow.
community, isn't it? And turning it back to
wow.
it's the individual and the clever machines. Let's wow. get rid of the community. I mean, terrifying.
And because these interfaces, at least as currently envisioned, are going to be audio. And so someone pointed out recently, based on this recent demo that OpenAI did of a child learning trigonometry with the help of an AI tutor, but it's talking to him as it's also showing him things. They said, you know, the end result of this is every child is in a soundproof cubicle with their headphones in as the AI talks to them. And you've taken away the classroom. You've taken away the relational encounter with the teacher. I think the potential for AI to sequence difficulty. So this is a big part of learning, is sequenced difficulty. You need to do the next hard thing. You can't jump from addition to linear regressions, but you can get through a series of steps of sequence difficulty. And AI is going to be great at that. And that will be a huge value for education. But the evidence is sequence difficulty is necessary but not sufficient. The other part is support, is actually you need another human being. You need a neurologist would say, you actually need another mind. This is kind of the insight of interpersonal neurobiology. You need another mind with your mind to actually do these hard things. I think AI is going to very much fail and fall short of its promise on that side. And it's actually going to intercept and replace the relational support that's needed for learning.
I recently read, I don't know if you saw it, the New York Times had done a series of articles where they'd followed a group of teenage 13-year-old girls in different parts of the US who had given them access to their phones for a whole year. And they had written almost like digital history of what it was like to be a 13-year-old girl, you know, who were all on TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat, and they were including stuff that they've been sending to their friends. And, you know, it's kind of horrifying in all the ways you'd expect it to be, you know, the epidemic of kind of cyberbullying, and, you know, you can never get away from it, because even at midnight, your phone is pinging next to your bed of all the drama that's going on in your peer group. But what I was really struck with is that actually in the three mums, none of whom, as far as I could tell, were kind of churchgoers or anything, were clearly all quite attuned to the destructiveness of this or the harmfulness of this, to the point where all three of them had as punishments for various infractions, sometimes online infractions, had kind of grounded the child's phone. And in one case, I think the girl had her phone removed for 6 weeks. She had no access to her phone, which I was reading this as kind of astonished at the kind of severity of it, it feels like people just don't know how to deal with this. They either swing from like total prohibition, you know, she goes dark in her friend's eyes, you know, if it's during the school holidays, they just don't see or hear from her with no warning for 6 weeks. Yeah. Or it's like full immersion, you know, you're Snapchatting random boys in different states that you met on TikTok, and it's all toxic, awful. Is there not a case to be saying, as the church, we need to be piloting some kind of healthy median here, rather than saying go as radical as you can, when most parents will just say that's unattainable? Is there a case for saying, should we really push for something that's kind of structured, controlled? We feel like we can't roll back entirely, but we don't want to obviously give them unfettered access.
Well, absolutely. And we have it. It's the principle of Sabbath. So Sabbath is the one day in seven, at least that's kind of the lowest rung on the ladder of Sabbath, because there's actually yearly Sabbaths and every 49-year kind of resets. But one day a week, the community of God is meant to detach from all the things that give you success, status, significance, self-provision, and experience a day of communal dependence and enjoyment, dependence on and enjoyment of God together. And Sabbath was, in its original context, this radical intervention in a world where everybody has to work every day, often under the thumb of the Pharaoh or whatever. And I think it's the perfect template. Now, I will say, I will just lay my cards out and say, I don't think 13-year-olds should be on social media ever for any reason, nor do I think they should be driving an automobile. I don't think they're neurologically prepared to drive an automobile. So they're not prepared for a 2-ton assembly of metal and glass that can ruin your own life or someone else. And I don't think they're prepared for a 8-ounce assembly of metal and glass that can ruin your life or someone else. So, you know, there are some things we just don't have our children do until they reach a certain level of maturity. And for me, there's a whole bunch of digital things that just shouldn't be there. But for the parents, I'm on, it used to be called Twitter. I'm on a dying social media network. And I use it 6 days, but on one day a week, I don't. And for that matter, on one day a week, we basically, anything that plugs in, we unplug, and anything that has an off switch, we turn it off. And that includes the electric lights in our house for the most part on Sundays. We minimize artificial illumination because we want to detach on a rhythmic basis from these things that we can become attached to or worse, addicted to. And Sabbath is like a circuit breaker on idolatry. It was a circuit breaker on the economic idolatry of the economic empires of the ancient Near East. But it's also a beautiful circuit breaker on the potential for these things to take over our lives. Because if you have one day in seven where you don't use the, whether it's the TV or the laptop or the, you know, smartphone, a day is long enough to detox if it's every week. And it's also long enough. It's kind of the amazing thing about spiritual disciplines that they're both like the prescription for what ails you, and they are the diagnostic technique. Because in that day, you discover how dependent you are on that thing. When you fast from food, or as I do every Lent, from wine, which I enjoy, you know, most weeks of the year. But during Lent, I have a chance to discover, am I becoming dependent on this? Am I relying on this for satisfaction or delight or sociability or whatever? And then you can take action if you discover you're dependent. But it also interrupts the dependence and makes you less dependent. So, by the way, for social media, I myself ended up adopting a practice where one day a week I'm off, 1 week a month I'm off. The first 7 days of every month, I don't even open Twitter or any of the other social media apps. And then 1 month a year, I'm off in the month of August. And I've found that tremendously freeing. And, you know, so I'm still there a lot, there, wherever there is. But that interruption pattern actually gives you freedom. So while I wouldn't give children all these things at once, I think for the parents to model for our kids these rhythms will go so far in helping them when it comes time for them to have a smartphone, which I do in the U.S. You know, we get a driver's license at 16, or you can. I think that's about the right time for a smartphone, is my own view. But we'll have been modeling for them for 16 years how to have a healthy rhythm of use and stepping away.
It's a wonderful idea of the circuit breaker. I think that's absolutely right. It's just because it just checks that addictive.
Yep.
You go cold turkey, don't you?
Yep.
And it exposes how addicted you might be, and therefore kind
exactly.
of raises the red flag that we would otherwise become kind of numb to because you don't notice.
That's right. Exactly.
It's interesting though, because it is a coordination problem. You can't be the one teenager who doesn't
right.
have a smartphone.
I know some of those one teenagers, and you can, but it's so hard.
Do they get it? Do you think do the Christian teenagers you know whose parents are adopting this kind of radical kind of exclusionism, if I'm kind of use that language, is saying no phones till 16, which, you know, we should acknowledge is genuinely radical in a world where most people are getting a phone's age nine, 10. So to wait a full 8 years, like, do they feel like my parents are trying to ruin my life? I can't have friends. Or do they get what is the heart behind why their parents are doing that?
I won't say everyone I've met is thrilled at the arrangement. It is actually amazing how many are quite happy with it. I'm not saying this is easy, but in every community, there's more than one family that's trying to do something different. And our kids were very different from their, it was a little pre-smartphone, although there were a lot of kids did have phones when my son was in high school, say. But they found the handful of friends either who didn't have it at all or who didn't have an addictive relationship to it and wanted to be their friends. And I also think you can over, it's kind of back to our conversation about risk and, you know, just even the, you know, going out and doing things that might hurt. We can overprotect our kids from the difficulty of being a flourishing human in a world that is full of idols and full of injustice. And my children are going to grow up, have now grown up, as you all have, into a world where there's much bigger questions ahead and much greater temptations to do real damage when you're in your 20s or 30s. And I didn't want to insulate my children from that kind of need to say, our family is different, which is what the people of God need to be able to say. Our family is different. We're part of a different kind of family. We have a different vision of what it is to be human. And therefore, we do different things. And it is absolutely hard to be that. and ask the Jewish people what it's been like to keep the Sabbath for 4,000 years in a world that largely had no notion of Sabbath. And even today in a Christian environment, observes it on the wrong day, you know, but there's still within a walk of where all of us live is a family that every Saturday, or really every Friday night, turns off the electric lights, deactivates the oven, and says a prayer and begins a day of rest while the rest of the culture around them just keeps doing its thing. And we've got to recover some of that as Christians, I think.
Andy, you dropped earlier that you thought that in some way young boys were going to be more damaged long term. I'm fascinated by that. What you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's come out of reflecting on the research that Jonathan Haidt has assembled. And there is this really interesting asymmetry in the kind of mental health outcomes. Now, in the West, certainly in the US, where I've spent the most time looking at summaries of the data, we have this kind of global increase in anxiety, depression, and I guess those two main categories of distress. There's just a general rise, and it's for both genders, it's all ages. But the effects for girls are much more striking than for boys. And I have a hunch about why this is the case. Boys and girls tend, as populations, to engage the digital world differently. Girls are primarily there for the social media, which is a way of kind of moving your social interactions online into a more tractable and controllable environment, and a kind of a less frictionful environment than in person. Boys are there for video games, which is a way of moving kind of mastery of the physical world into a more tractable and frictionless environment. The motivation of girls is to connect to one another and kind of form groups and then establish who has kind of really dominance. I mean, we don't like to use that word, but it is kind of the play. The work of middle school girls is figuring out who's who and who's how what. Do they relate. The work of boys primarily is to demonstrate that they've mastered something that impresses their friends. And it used to be you did that out in the woods or you did it on the football pitch or whatever. Now you do it in Call of Duty and you show your male friends what you're able to do with your agility and your quick response rate and so forth. My hunch is that, the evidence is that this moving the social world online is terrible for girls. It allows bullying to happen. It allows all kinds of shame to happen. But I think the skills that they are learning in social media actually translate pretty well to being a member of an information economy where a lot of work is done on screens. And it's all about how to be kind of a participant in a social network. And that's what it is to work in a corporation. It's what it is actually to be an effective university student. And so what we're seeing is middle and high school girls have terrible, terrible times, but young women, that is university and above, are actually doing quite well right now. So at least in the US, in our elite universities, it's trending towards 60% female. And it would probably be more if they weren't kind of balancing through admissions the genders. Young women are doing pretty well. Boys are not harmed so directly by kind of feeling like you mastered a video game. That's not a terribly damaging thing. But what's happening is you're foregoing the preparation for actual life in the world that is not a video game. And I think we're seeing the outcomes among young men are terrible. Young men are they're not actually engaging with their kind of full capacities in the world. They're not confident. They're withdrawing from many aspects of kind of adult responsibility. So if you want to sum it up, terrible for girls, not so bad for young women, not so bad for boys. Terrible for young men, which also ends up being pretty bad for young women because many of them are looking for a young man to be their partner in life. And they're looking around and saying, I don't see any men who are even attempting to kind of make a difference in the world. So that's my thesis.
That is really fascinating. I would just, I'm sure you're right. It's a very, very interesting fact. I would just add in, though, there's another thing that young men do particularly beside video games, and that's porn.
Porn. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Exactly. I think, you know, same sort of
same
thing. If you fry your, I was talking to somebody who said he was talking to a 20-year-old who he said he described him as having fried his brain on 10 years of hardcore porn.
Yep.
And that, you know, he was not able to have adult time relationships.
Right. And if you think about it, if you ask that 15-year-old who's on a diet of porn, you know, what's your mental health today? It's not necessarily going to be that bad. It's a sort of temporarily rewarding experience. It's just creating a long-term deficit that is profound and is going to show up 10 or 15 years later. And that's why I think we're seeing these asymmetric results in adolescence, but it's going to play out very, very tragically, really, for men and women, unless we turn this ship around. And there's also the grace of neuroplasticity, which is that people can be rescued from all this, but it's going to take rescue, I think.
I have a question about the future, and the porn is actually as a helpful example where I think the conversation in wider culture beyond church circles, which has obviously always been pretty hostile to pornography, feels like it's shifting. And maybe 10 years ago, there was a sense of, yep, there's lots of porn on the internet. Okay, so what? As long as it's adults consenting, you know, crack on. Whereas I think today, you don't have to look hard or to find particularly conservative Christians to find voices saying, I think actually our epidemic of online porn might be socially harmful. Do you feel optimistic that a similar shift is occurring around technology in general? You know, I often talk with my wife and say, the one thing I'm grateful of is that I didn't have children for the first wave of this, and that our children will be hitting their teenage years in the 2030s, by which point I'm hoping as a society we've established some healthier ground rules. Do you feel optimistic that we're getting to a better place, or at least we're asking better questions about this beyond the confines of the church?
I am quite hopeful about this, actually. I mean, I don't know, but I actually think 2024, when we're having this conversation, it's my own hunch that it is the inflection point in a number of important respects on these matters. And it's partly because John Haidt's book has connected in such a powerful way. And if you know your maths, you know that inflection points are like a place on a curve where the shape just starts to change and you don't actually see the change at that point. But so they're not like the top or the bottom of the curve, but they're where the concavity or convexity, they say, changes. And I think we are actually living through that right now, where the momentum has shifted from let it happen, this is moral panic, don't worry, to we should not be letting all this happen. There is a place for panic when the ship is going down. John Haidt says, was it a moral panic to worry about the effects of cigarettes on lungs? No, it was not. Did everybody see that in 1965? No, they did not. Was there an inflection point in the 1970s or 80s when in fact the momentum started to shift? Absolutely. And I think we're at that at this moment. And we all need to contribute to the kind of shared conversation with our neighbors that isn't just based on Christian conviction, though is definitely for us animated by it, that there is a better way to do this. And it will involve some restrictions, because law is tremendously helpful, or regulation is helpful, when it takes the burden of collective action off individuals and the community just decides we're not going to give an automobile to an 8-year-old or a cigarette for that matter. Hmm.
We could carry on the conversation forever, but just very briefly, and we're going to have to let you go, Andy, but I totally buy this vision that we need to redeem technology. We need technology that actually helps us flourish. We need technology that helps us to grow in strength and in love and so on. Do you have any kind of vision of what that looks like? You know, what would advanced technology that helps us grow in love, that helps us be these full-orbed human beings, what would it look like?
I do have a picture of it, partly because my wife is a scientist, an experimental scientist, and she's a physicist specifically. And in her training and the early decades of her work, she's shifted to some other things now, but she worked in very, very high-tech labs where, you know, it was full of technology, lasers and computers and all kinds of things. But watching my wife do her research has been such an education. I was trained in like classics and humanities, but watching science as it's done by real scientists, it is so much an enterprise of heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love, actually. The level of trust and collaboration among members of a research group is quite beautiful to see. And it's very engaging of human beings. And what they're using is all technology, but they are not using it as entertainment or distraction or to replace human activity. They're using it to kind of focus human attention on some aspect of the world, which inevitably produces a sense of wonder and amazement and connects beautifully to this mathematics we can do that engages our minds. And it's all technological in the sense that there's all these instruments, right? But they're not replacing human beings, and they're actually calling forth the very highest capabilities of human beings. And for me, that's a template. So I talk in my book, The Life We're Looking For, about re-aiming our desire from devices that will just replace and displace us to instruments that actually enable us to engage in the world. And medical instruments, very, very similar. But then musical instruments, another example. I play the modern piano. You know, the modern piano could only be made once you had a lot of metallurgy and factories and so forth. But when I sit down to play the piano, I'm engaged in the world in a very full way. And I actually think we could ask our devices to be that. I'll just give you one more quick example. There's Instagram is the dominant photo sharing app, of course. And when you open up Instagram, there's two cameras on modern smartphones. One faces outward and one faces you. And when you open up Instagram, by default, the selfie camera is active. So it's basically, they made a design decision that the thing you want to show the world is you. There's a competing app, a beautiful app, that also allows you to share photos called Visco, VSCO, that's had some real success in the market. And the designers of Visco, who incidentally, one of their founders is very much a Christian and working as a Christian in technology, just made a simple design decision. When you open Visco, the active camera faces the world. And it's inviting you to look at the world as an artist and to show your friends what you see in the world and compose an image out of the world you're encountering rather than just composing an image of yourself. And does that mean Visco can't be used in kind of damaging ways? Actually, no, it can still be distorted by the incentives of social media. They've struggled with that. But I think that's a beautiful like metaphor for what we could do, is that so many of these things could be used as artists would use them rather than as self-interested self-promoters would use them. But you sort of have to make the choice, and it kind of helps if someone gives you a design presentation of it that says, why don't you use it this way rather than this way? I think it can happen. I think it can happen.
Well, it's good to end on a hopeful note, isn't it? Rather than a doom-mongering
one. Truly. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. We'll get to talk for much longer, but we'll have to draw our conversation to a close there. Would you mind, if people are interested in picking up any of your books, going deeper on this, could you just remind us of some of the titles and where they can be found?
There are two with a bonus. The first one is The TechWise Family, which is really about everyday steps for putting technology in its proper place in the home. My daughter wrote a follow-up called My TechWise Life. She wrote it when she was 19. It's just a teenager's account of what it was like to grow up in our very odd home and very hopeful, actually beautifully done. And then the more recent book is called The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological World, which is about the bigger picture, I think, behind all of these things.
Brilliant. Well, I strongly recommend, if you're interested, go and find these books online and read them. Andy's a really important voice in the culture on this, from the church and beyond. So we're really grateful to have you on the show, Andy. Thank you very much.
Thank you both so much.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for listening. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback, your thoughts, particularly if you're a parent trying to wrestle with some of these things with your own kids or other contexts, maybe in school. Do let us know. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's one.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.